Mr. Rapple, before you leave, could we have you sign in on the sheet?
I did.
Did you? Okay, you must have copied it before. Okay. Do you also have Mr. Cannon's signature? Okay, so Mr. Cannon will need to sign in before he leaves. That's all right. Thank you.
May it please the court, Mr. Whitworth. My name is Martin Cannon. I'm here representing John Howard, and I suppose to a lesser extent his sister, Peggy Howard. I would like to reserve, 2 minutes for rebuttal time. You really have to love this case. It's straight out of law school, black acre, white acre, all kinds of stuff that's fun. We don't get too many of them. The man is on his deathbed dying. He summons his nephew and his niece's husband to the hospital room. He executes a deed to the niece's husband.
He has what evidence is there he was on his deathbed at that time?
Well, he's in the hospital.
He's in the hospital. A lot of people go to the hospital and they're not dying.
Right, no, but he's in the hospital. He's in bad shape. He did die shortly thereafter. So
how long thereafter?
I want to say about 2 weeks. He was probably in the hospital for 2 weeks or so before he died. I don't recall from the time of the gifts to the time of the death. It was considerably shorter. It was closer to the end, I think. I'm not sure about that. And I think from a legal standpoint on this case, I don't know that it matters much. It's the time span from the gifts to the death is fairly short any way you slice it. But he executes the deed to Mr. Smith, and he has Mr. Howard retrieve his cards from the wallet in the corner and gives them to him. Makes comments evincing the gift, but the court excluded those and found that there was no gift. It's been well briefed, but we need to address really two ideas here, hearsay and cookies. On hearsay, you have to look at the big picture. Anybody can look at the evidence, including the excluded evidence, and see exactly what happened here. It's reasonably reliable, it's reasonably credible, and very importantly, it's undisputed. There is no alternative version, no competing version of the events here. And you can see what happens. Everything makes sense. Everything's acceptable, or at least not shocking, or you don't see any nefariousness or anything like that. But the trial court nonetheless leaves some chinks in the picture by failing to properly regard, I think, the exceptions to the hearsay rule.
Mr. Cannon, let me ask you this. If the court had allowed that testimony in, and there is evidence of the decedent's intent that he wanted his nephew to have his bank accounts, simply by giving him his debit cards and his access information, does that convey the bank accounts to the nephew?
I think so. Not the accounts, though. And I would get into that in the second part of my argument about cookies. But no, it doesn't convey the account. It conveys money, much as though as if he had written a check. Went once.
Except that a check has a specific dollar amount to it. I mean, your client could only access this money through an ATM machine. If he went into the bank and tried to withdraw money with those, he wouldn't be able to do it because his name's not on the account. He couldn't
well,
do
except
it
that he had the PIN
the account.
He had the PIN number.
Right.
And I think that would allow him to do it, just like the PIN number allows you to do it at an ATM.
I think they probably would ask him for ID, but anyway, that's not in the record. But he couldn't go in and close the account. He couldn't go in and transfer all that money into his own account.
Right.
So even if all that testimony comes in, is it still a valid transfer?
Yes, and I think that's the second question in the case. You know, we have hearsay issues, but we also have that next issue. And yes, it's a transfer. If I give a guy a blank check, I make it out to Joe Smith and sign my name to it and give it to him. I say, and he, maybe he knows what's in my account or whatever. He can write it for what he wants. It's a good check. And of course, Mr. Howard at the time, like most of us these days, you don't really know how much is in your account anyway. He's not going to say, John, there's $25,002 in my account. I want you to have it. He does what's reasonable to convey the contents of the account. And interestingly, once he's got the cards and the PIN numbers, Mr. Howard can go to an ATM and he can take out all the money. The actions, his ability to do so requires no further human involvement. A check, which I would submit we wouldn't be arguing about, requires him to go to a bank, at least if he wants to cash it, present some ID, give him a thumbprint, you know, whatever that is. It's actually more involved. The debit cards are unconditional, and they are carte blanche. There's no limitation on what he can do. So, of course, he doesn't own the account. He can't go change the name or change signatories or anything like that, or add himself as a joint signer or a joint tenant. We aren't concerned with the ownership of the account. We're just concerned with the money in it.
But you're saying that your client acquired ownership of the money inside it the minute he got the cards and the PIN numbers?
Not when he got the cards and the PIN numbers. A person can steal my cards and PIN numbers. He got these things when there was intent, delivery, and acceptance. The intent to make the gift, the delivery, and then Mr. Howard accepting and making use of the cards.
And the only way we can know the intent is if the statement comes in that your client is claiming that his uncle said that was for him, right?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Interesting.
I don't know. I'm trying to think of what was in evidence that wasn't excluded. I don't know if we quite got to the intent. The statements that shore up the gift were excluded.
But that happened, you said, sometime shortly before the uncle's death, that he acquired the cards?
Yes.
So you're in agreement that delivery of the card and provision of the PIN number isn't sufficient?
Well, delivery of the card and provision of the PIN number probably isn't sufficient, because I could say, here's my card, here's the PIN number, go get money to pay for my funeral. That's not a gift. He can give him access without making the gift. The gift is dependent on intent, which I think would be furnished in this case by the excluded evidence.
It's interesting that your client didn't make any withdrawals from that account while Mr. Howard was still alive.
There's no evidence in the record as to what his thinking was in respect to that.
There's just evidence that... When did Mr. Howard die? May 21st?
I really don't recall.
2 days later, May 23rd, a withdrawal, 24th, a withdrawal, 25th, a withdrawal. It was every day a withdrawal shortly after he died, nothing prior to his death.
I think Mr. Howard would tell you he was,
if it was his, if it had been gifted to him, he had access immediately or rights to it immediately.
I'm not sure if it's in the record, but Mr. Howard was probably also being respectful of his uncle. You just don't want to run out and take all the money. Obviously, he's not hiding the fact that he's got the cards. You can't sneak money out of an account using these cards. But he waited until his uncle died, I think just because he doesn't want to look untoward. He doesn't want to look graspy. I don't know if that's in the record. But I don't think any of us can speculate about the significance of it. The question is, if the gift occurred when it seems to have occurred, it doesn't matter if he took the money right away or a month later. The gift was already, if the gift occurred, he owns the money. So getting to the hearsay, we say state of mind, intent, plan, black letter law straight out of the statute. The other side says, well, the statements don't reflect state of mind, they reflect the substance of the gift or something like that. I don't know what that means, but substance is important. We say admissions against interest. Here's my money, here's my house. He says it's not an admission against interest because it's estate planning. That's in everybody's interest. But that's like saying that if I admit to the cops that I killed the professor with the candlestick in the library, that's not an admission against interest because it's going to do me good at sentencing. He's giving away the farm. And unlike estate planning, if he then doesn't die, he's got a problem because he just gave away his house and all his money. With respect to cookies, Whitworth focuses on ownership and control of the account. It's a red herring. If I'm on my deathbed and I call my son and say, Joey, there's some great cookies in the cookie jar on the kitchen counter. I want you to have them. They're yours. He says, thanks, Pop. They're his cookies. They remain his cookies, even if I die before he retrieves them. Mr. Whitworth focuses on the cookie jar. We don't claim the cookie jar. Never have. We own the cookies. If Mr. Howard had written my client a check for $25,000, we wouldn't have ownership or control of the account either. But I don't think we'd be here. So you got to go back, look at the gift itself. Forget the trappings and the framework in which account transactions occur. Look at the gift itself. It occurred. The evidence is good. The judge was incorrect on the hearsay exceptions. If you reverse those, I think you can find the gift occurred and can enter an order accordingly.
Did you argue the admission against interest exception?
I believe we did. Yeah. Because those objections were banged around pretty well, I think. But I could be wrong. I went for the transcript preparing for this ruling, and I don't have it. I thought I had it, so it might have gotten away. And I'm not entirely sure about that.
Thank you.
I eat up all my love.
You ate all the cookies.
I know.
Mr. Whitworth.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Richard Whitworth. I'm here today representing Judy Forrester, the personal representative and appellee in this. I think at the end of his statement, Mr. Cannon brought our argument to its fruition when he was talking about the fact that if this had been a check, we wouldn't be here today. I will agree with that. Had there been a check written, had there been a piece of paper with a specific statement that said, I want John Howard to have all of my bank accounts, it was dated on a specific date and signed by by Robert Howard, we wouldn't be here. But that's not the case. We're here today because the appellant wants to argue that a hearsay statement should authenticate a hearsay document to support a hearsay assertion. And as far as the way I see it, members of the court, it's just too much to ask here. And especially, I think, that the interpretation that the appellant is asking the court to make of this series of events has the potential to do damage to the structure that has been set forth for handling the passage of estates and even, basically, for how we handle our banking issues. As I think the court was trying to point out to the appellant, there are other ways of getting the name of John Howard onto this account. And I think we suggested that in our brief, which were obviously make him a joint owner, make him a payable on death beneficiary.
But his argument isn't that it was a transfer of the account. Rather, it was a transfer of the contents of the account.
And, Your Honor, I guess I do need to come back to that because as far as I'm concerned, the big question here is, was there a gift? And I do not believe there was. I believe that when, if you take all of the statements at their face value, which we're not conceding that the court needs to, but if you take all those statements, John Howard would have received Bob Howard's, basically his wallet, with his debit cards and access to his PIN numbers in there. If anything, as we've stated in our brief, it may have given him a limited agency for a limited amount of time to have access to some funds. But those were not accessed, as Judge Bishop pointed out, during the life of Mr. Howard. None of those transactions occurred until 2 days after his death, and then $4,800 is withdrawn within a matter of a few weeks from that account. This is, I guess you have to then go on and say, if handing those debit cards represents a gift, then is my handing a blank check to somebody likewise, a gift of all the money in that account? Is my handing a checkbook to someone a gift of all the money in my account? Mr. Howard, or the decedent Mr. Howard, gave the John Howard access, didn't give him contents of the account, at least.
What is the evidence that he gave him access?
Pardon me?
What is the evidence that the decedent gave the appellant access?
Well, if we accept the idea that he did receive his wallet with his debit card and access to those numbers,
but the only evidence,
arguably he's got access.
But the only evidence is John Howard's testimony that he got it.
Correct, Your Honor. And again, it's, I think, three layers of that trying to substantiate the alleged gift. One of the things that I think is important here, and which Mr. Cannon pointed out in his brief, was that he thought that once those cards were given to John Howard, that Robert Howard had lost all authority over those accounts. And I can't say that that's more wrong. At any time, Robert Howard, by phone or by any other mechanism, could have contacted the bank and put a complete halt to anything going on off of ATM cards. to that effect, I also wanted to clear up a couple of issues that came up at the beginning of Mr. Cannon's argument. And I do not believe that this is properly called a deathbed event. There was no evidence in the record that death was imminent.
He doesn't argue dying declaration. He argues state of mind.
I understand, Your Honor. And it was 10 days later after these alleged events occurred when Mr. Howard did pass away.
So why does state of mind not apply?
Your Honor, especially in this situation, I'm looking at the state of mind as it's in some ways it's too close a mirror to the statements that they're trying to support. If you go back to, and I'm not going to remember the name of the case right now,
Well, I'm thinking of the Klinger case, which is the videotape of the will. Okay, and she said, they're videotaping the will, and she's saying, I'm executing my will. My intent is to leave thus and such to so-and-so. That was state of mind exception.
And I guess part of what I see in all of this, Your Honor, I think the court in this particular situation was making the rulings not only on the court's interpretation of that hearsay exception, but also was making that as colored through the fact that the judge had heard all the witnesses, and it was in part a ruling based upon the credibility of the witness.
But that goes to the weight and sufficiency, not the admissibility.
I understand, Your Honor. And I think, as we also argued in our brief, that even if the court would determine that that particular evidentiary determination be reversed, I think it's harmless error in that the court could still come to the same determination as to whether or not this was a gift and whether or not the estate should be closed based on the petition filed by Mrs. Forrester.
But we don't know what the trial court would have done because it sustained those objections, thereby keeping that information out.
Well, Your Honor, I think the court made that determination based upon the observations and determinations that it made in regard to the witnesses that were there testify.
Aren't the statements that Mr. Howard, the appellant, offered, weren't they just going to the truth of the matter asserted, that as to the intent to gift these funds to his nephew, and not so much to his state of mind at that time? What other evidence was there as to state of mind at that time?
Your Honor, that, I guess that it is a probably more articulately states where I was going, and it goes back to my statement earlier that we've got a hearsay statement to authenticate a hearsay document to substantiate a hearsay assertion. And I have to take also into account that the two witnesses that were promoting that line of thought were the two people that stood most to benefit.
But the state of mind exception is an admission that this statement is hearsay. But here's an exception to it, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So the fact that it's hearsay doesn't mean it was properly excluded. The question is, does the state of mind exception apply to it?
Exactly, Your Honor.
And was there any other evidence as to what was happening at the time that the appellant claims the cards got into his possession?
No, Your Honor. I guess what I would say is there was no, while there may or may not have been other people who may or may not have allegedly been present, I know that my client was not present, that Peggy Smith, Mr. Cannon's other client, said that she was not present to hear the statements or to, in regard to either this account or the house that was involved. And again, this goes back to those statements I think could easily be construed to be exceedingly self-serving.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Cannon, have time left? He is over. Oh, that's right. You ate the cookies. I forgot already. Well, quickly.
The D.
All right. So the case is submitted. Counsel, you're excused. Thank you for coming today.
Thank you.